I'm Pam Pusa, Fox News. The CDC says Americans who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19 can mostly ditch their face coverings outdoors and indoors, but the move isn't being embraced everywhere. Some states like New Jersey, New York, and California are keeping mask mandates in place. Stores are also deciding whether or not to still require face coverings.
Kroger, the nation's largest grocery chain, still requires masks for shoppers. The same with Home Depot and Starbucks. But Trader Joe's and Walmart say you can lose the mask if you're vaxxed. Still, there could be mask confusion. The Retail Industry Leaders Association says the CD policy creates ambiguity for retailers and could put retailers and their employees in incredibly difficult situations.
Fox's Chad Pergram. The military is being mobilized in rural areas of India as a devastating second wave of virus infections starts spreading there. In the country's two biggest cities, the number of daily cases has dropped. Protesters around the world are reacting to the escalating violence in the Middle East. Several thousand people marched in Australia today, many of them chanting Free Palestine and Free Gaza. Demonstrations also planned in parts of Europe as the fighting rages on.
The Israeli Air Force is bombing targets throughout the Gaza Strip, and the artillery units were firing shells at Hamas and Islamic Jihad positions. The damage done to Gaza will set the Palestinian people back years. This level of conflict hasn't been seen in the region since Operation Protective Edge in 2014.
Fox's Trey Gingst. From Gaza, Hamas militants continue to fire rockets into Israel. The Red Planet has another visitor. A rover from China has landed on Mars. America's listening to Fox News. As Britain prepares to further loosen COVID-19 restrictions, it's also accelerating its vaccine campaign. On Monday, all restaurants, bars, and museums can largely reopen, and people will be allowed to socialize indoors. But the emergence of a variant first detected in India has the UK speeding up its second dose distribution schedule. Instead of waiting 12 weeks for the second jab, people over 50 can receive their second dose in 8 weeks. About 68% of the adult population has received a first dose. For millions of Americans, it's been a struggle to scrape together the monthly rent or mortgage payment. As of now, a nationwide moratorium on evictions remains in place. But the question is, for how much longer?
U.S. District Judge Dabney Friedrich ruled last week that the CDC moratorium on evictions for renters was unconstitutional. The CDC had said it was necessary to prevent further spread of COVID and estimated that it may have prevented more than an additional 433,000 cases. The judge noted that data when she stayed her own ruling while the Justice Department appeals. Groups representing landlords said they're losing between $14 and $19 billion a month collectively. The judge said it's unlikely the CDC would succeed on the merits and that their moratorium raises serious legal questions. Either way, some individual counties, cities, and states have issued moratoriums on evictions. Jessica Rosenthal, Fox News.
Who knew that hand sanitizer and cigarettes could be a dangerous combination? A man in Maryland learned that lesson the hard way after flames erupted inside his car as he smoked a cigarette while using hand sanitizer. According to local media, the driver suffered burns to his hands and inner thighs. The car was apparently totaled after embers from a cigarette ignited a handful of sanitizer. I'm Pam Pusa, Fox News.
In D.C. on 295, 395, and 695, right now there isn't any accidents and no construction set up, so you should be traveling at the posted speed limit in D.C. Now in Maryland, on the Beltway, inner loop, the off-ramp has been reopened at the Annapolis Road exit, exit 20. There was a disabled vehicle, so you shouldn't find any issues passing exit 20. In Virginia, on the outer loop of the Beltway, there is a disabled vehicle. Left lane is blocked in Alexandria at Telegraph Road, exit 176. That's the only delay on the Virginia side of the Beltway. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny this morning. Cool conditions to start your day, but temperatures will warm up into the mid-70s through the afternoon. We'll see a hit or miss shower, but for the most part, very isolated. Later on tonight, lows back in the 50s. Clouds will increase after midnight. Mostly cloudy into your Sunday morning. I think we'll be dry tomorrow morning, but we will have the possibility for some afternoon showers. Could even have a couple rumbles of thunder. Not quite as warm either. High temperatures around 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Now, the Saturday morning update. 105.9 FM.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. How you doing on gas? How much do you have in your tank? Or are you fortunate enough to have an electric vehicle? According to CNN this morning, 80% of the pumps are dry in D.C. And as of last night in the state of Virginia, there was a report that 45% of the gas pumps are running on empty in Virginia. And Maryland in a similar situation this morning. We don't have an exact number, but all up and down the East Coast, we have seen the chaos created by the hackers' attack on the Colonial Pipeline. Now, you'd hope at a time like this that there would be a response from the government, which would be a real strong response, and that would make us feel all a little more comfortable. We have a Secretary of Energy, that's Jennifer Granholm, and we talked about her financial interests in electric vehicle manufacturing companies last week. The specific one is Proterra. And Jennifer Granholm was doing a press conference this week, and I don't know how this makes you feel if you have a gasoline-powered vehicle, but here's how she addressed the situation, and she took some heat on this.
We obviously are all in on making sure that we meet the president's goals of getting to 100% clean electricity by 2035 and net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And, you know, if you drive an electric car, this would not be affecting you, clearly.
Okay, so that's Jennifer Granholm. And if this was an electric car, wouldn't it be affecting you? Well, how about all of us that don't have electric cars yet, Jennifer? How did Lindsey Graham feel about that?
That was the dumbest thing in the world. If we had all electric cars, the pipeline hack wouldn't matter. Well, what if they take down the power company?
Well, that's a fairly logical response. And I want to go back to another Jennifer Granholm clip. This is cut eye, because we heard so much from Joe Biden about the Keystone Pipeline. The first thing he did, you know, when he came in was to blow up the Keystone Pipeline before it was constructed, put a lot of people out of work. And this is our Secretary of Energy talking about the pipeline. And listen very carefully to what she says at the end about how the pipeline is the best.
These are not easy solutions because there may or may not be the right rail cars. There may not or may not be the deep water ports available. This is why we have doubled down on ensuring that there's an ability to truck oil in, gas in. But it's the pipe is the best way to go.
The pipe is the best way to go. Why didn't she tell Joe Biden that before he whacked the Keystone Pipeline? Are you confused a little bit? I mean, do you have a lack of confidence in what the heck is going on in this administration? Pretty evident right there that these folks are in over their heads. Well, how about the border? What about the southern border? We'll get to that in a second. But I do want to make you feel better about gas, because Mayor Pete, who is now our Secretary of Transportation, even though we're 80% dry in D.C. and 45% dry in Virginia, he's feeling pretty good about it.
We're going to see that progress and process toward normal continue through this weekend. But so far, all indications are that it's been going very well.
And that, of course, is the former mayor of Indianapolis, Pete Buttigieg, who is now our Secretary of Transportation. We've got a lot to cover on the Saturday Morning Update. Coming up next, we're going to get into the situation at the border. There were hearings on Capitol Hill this week. It got a little feisty there. I think you'll find another sort of lack of confidence when we get into how the administration is handling the southern border. And are you a little bit confused about masks today? They've been going back and forth and back and forth and around in circles and then back and forth and then backwards in the circle on mask guidance, on CDC guidance. We're going to get into the two this morning because I'm not sure where we are on that one, because they just keep changing the rules. But we'll get to it. That's just a couple of the things that we're going to be talking about this morning. Obviously, we will be checking in with Jennifer Harper at the Washington Times, and she writes Inside the Beltway. She's got some very interesting numbers on how the media is handling the Biden administration and basically giving them a pass on so many different areas. We'll get into that with Jennifer this morning. We're going to be talking with John Gizzi. Of course, John is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. And we'll ask John all about the move of Elise Stefanik to head the House Republican Conference as Liz Cheney voted out this week. We're going to talk to John about the new ambassador to Japan. This is not a man who was known for diplomacy. Now, I could either leave it as an open tease and make you wait until 7 o'clock, or I could have you laugh now, and then you can laugh even harder at 7 o'clock when you hear that the guy the Biden administration is going to send to Japan is our ambassador. And, you know, the Japanese are very, very prim and proper when it comes to just sort of the societal norms. I mean, I have met Japanese business people, and they will hand you their business card. They are very formal. They are very polite. They are very cordial. They are very diplomatic. Who are we sending? Rahm Emanuel, the attack dog, former Chicago mayor, former chief of staff in the Obama administration, probably the last guy that you would expect would be diplomatic with probably one of the most important allies that we have and probably one of the most diplomatic corps. Rahm Emanuel, ambassador to Japan, must be joking. And also this morning, we're going to be talking with Cheryl Atkinson. She's got some very interesting news on COVID-19 and what it has meant in terms of the spread of child trafficking and sex abuse. Just a surprising story coming up from Cheryl on that. And also, we're going to be talking with Cheryl about what's happening with the medical equipment after COVID-19. There's a real serious maintenance problems and getting some of the medical equipment repaired and long wait times. And what does that mean to the medical community? We're going to talk with KT McFarland coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. And, you know, again, a little lack of confidence here. Joe Biden, our president, was asked the other day if he would take a retaliatory strike against the hackers of the pipeline, and just said, hey, would you, you know, take a retaliatory strike? He says, no. And I'm sitting here going, what do you mean, no? What kind of message does that traffic to the next hackers? Might you have said, we have all options on the table and we'll take whatever action is necessary to prevent this from happening in the future? No. When asked the question, would you take a retaliatory strike against the hackers? He says, no. That's our president. That's leadership, everybody. And we're going to talk with KT McFarland about that. And we'll also talk with KT about the very serious situation in Gaza, the rocket attacks from Hamas on Israel, the Israeli response, and that's coming up with KT this morning. Also, we'll talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and he'll take us in depth as well on the Hamas situation and what that means, the relationship with Iran. So we got a lot coming up here on the Saturday Morning Update. Jim Trusty's going to join us, and we're going to get into sort of the direction, the priorities the Department of Justice has taken. So hopefully we have a very interesting lineup for you this morning. First off, though, we'll get to Al BD. He's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the Maryland side of the Beltway, from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, on the inner loop and the outer loop, you won't be tapping the brakes. Nothing in the roadway to slow you down. Between the two beltways, on the BW Parkway and on 95, northbound lanes are clear and the southbound lanes are clear. Also in Prince George's County, on Route 50, from the Beltway out to the Bay Bridge, eastbound lanes and the westbound lanes, nothing to slow you down. At the Bay Bridge, you got two lanes headed east and three lanes coming west. And in Montgomery County, on 270, nothing to report, northbound and southbound between the Beltway and Frederick. And now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny this morning, cool conditions to start your day, but temperatures will warm up into the mid-70s through the afternoon. We'll see a hit or miss shower, but for the most part, very isolated. Later on tonight, lows back in the 50s. Clouds will increase after midnight, mostly cloudy into your Sunday morning. I think we'll be dry tomorrow morning, but we will have the possibility for some afternoon showers. Could even have a couple rumbles of thunder. Not quite as warm either. High temperatures around 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
It's 46 degrees, 620 in the nation's capital on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. It's good to have you along with us. Big controversy, obviously, over the southern border. Secretary of Homeland Security continues to say the border's closed, everything's under control. He probably doesn't watch Fox News, so he probably doesn't have much of an idea about what's going on down there. I think he's been down once or twice. President hasn't been there. The vice president hasn't been there. But Mayorkas would have us believe that the border's closed and everything's fine. But if you watch Fox News every day, you see more and more illegal immigrants crossing the border. And some of the serious accidents that happen, whether it's a vehicular accident, whether it's a drowning, it's a very serious situation. Senate hearing this week on Capitol Hill with Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas, and he was grilled by Republicans.
I'm not able to sit here and not comment on this idea that somehow this is Donald Trump's fault.
I do not think that the prior administration supported legal immigration. They threw up every obstacle possible to permit legal immigration.
We're not talking about legal immigration, Mr. Secretary. We're talking about all these people coming across illegally. Boy, that's the strategy, though. And that all politicians do that, Republican or Democrat. You just don't answer the question. You just say whatever you want to say. Rick Scott chimed in, of course, the Florida Republican senator.
Are you disappointed that President Biden and Vice President Harris have not taken the time to come to the border?
Absolutely not. What the president and the vice president have done is directed me to address the challenges at the border.
I thought Vice President Harris had been directed to kind of be in charge of that. But that's a little more confusion, a little more lack of confidence in this administration. Mitt Romney. Now, you know, a lot of criticism of Mitt Romney over the years from conservative Republicans, but Mitt was on target as he grilled the Secretary of Homeland Security.
These kids are coming here making that kind of journey, and they're not going to be allowed to stay in this country.
90% of these children have a parent or legal guardian in the United States.
90% of the children have a parent or legal guardian in the United States? I find that questionable. If the legal guardian or the parent was in the U.S., they would have left the children down. 90%? I mean, I could see 20, 30, 40%, 90%. I don't know about that one. It all depends on where you get your data, I guess. And here's another one from Mitt Romney. This is a very, very strong exchange with Mitt Romney and the Secretary of Homeland Security, Mayorkas.
We're seeing apprehensions at the border that have skyrocketed.
We can, in fact, meet the challenge.
Yeah, what I find astonishing, Mr. Chairman, is that we have the secretary responsible for securing our border and our immigration system who doesn't recognize these charts as being a problem. I find that extraordinary and extremely damning.
And that's Mitt Romney, and that's just a taste of the latest on the southern border, and we're not seeing much progress there. Now, are you confused about masks and the mask mandate? And here's partially why there is some confusion. And this is Peter Doocy, White House correspondent for Fox, as he asks Jen Psaki a fairly straight question.
What happened to President Biden saying in March that he thought lifting mask mandates before every adult American goes and gets a shot is Neanderthal thinking?
Well, first, let me say that the president, our North Star, has been listening to the guidance of our health and medical experts and teams, and that's exactly what we're doing in this case.
Okay, so we're all a little bit confused about what to do in terms of masks, and I know we've all wanted to take them off, but it's just this sort of back and forth as the CDC is confusing us. Now, am I overreacting? Well, I always check out CNN to see what's going on Saturday morning, and I was watching in the 5 o'clock hour. And you know the little chyron up on the screen, or what they call the lower third in the industry, right at the bottom of the screen, the little message that goes across there, usually propaganda? Well, this is how it read on CNN, quoting directly. Updated CDC mask guidance sparks confusion. I'm like, really? CNN put that up on a screen? Updated CDC mask guidance sparks confusion? Moments later, Chyron, CNN, U.S. faces patchwork of mask rules after new CDC guidance? I mean, what happened? You know, typically, the White House is writing the chyrons down at the bottom of the screen on CNN. So maybe, it's middle of the night. Maybe they didn't get that message over in time to get it up this morning. Now, what does that mean if you're going to go shopping? Well, since the new guidelines were issued, retailers have started announcing changes to mask policies for fully vaccinated customers. Trader Joe's, Walmart, Sam's Club, Costco, and Publix among the first to confirm updates to mask requirements, leading the way for mask-free shopping except where required by state or local mandate. In some cases, vaccinated store employees can also go to work without a mask. Many retailers, including Apple, Target, CVS, and Walgreens, say they are still evaluating the CDC guidance, but they say they could update policies. So some confusion there. And I would ask the question that they say it's okay that if you're fully vaccinated, you can take the mask off. But how about those people that are not vaccinated who are taking the mask off? Huh, what does that mean? What's to say that somebody is not going to go out who is unvaccinated and take the mask off and pretend that they're vaccinated? What's to stop that? Whatever. It's all confusing. It's 6:28. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. In the news at 6:30, an Israeli airstrike on a house in Gaza City has killed at least 7 Palestinians. That airstrike early this morning in the western part of Gaza City recorded the highest number of fatalities in a single hit. The militant group Hamas reporting the number is likely to rise as efforts to recover casualties from under the rubble of the house on the edge of the Shati refugee camp are still ongoing. Still no immediate update from the health ministry. Resident nearby says Israeli warplanes dropped at least 3 bombs on the 3-story house without warning. Shortly afterward, Hamas said it fired a salvo of rockets at southern Israel in response to that airstrike. A new national terrorism alert is warning that violent extremists may take advantage of the easing of pandemic restrictions to conduct attacks. The alert does not cite any specific threats, but it warns of potential danger from a, quote, increasingly complex and volatile mix that includes domestic terrorists inspired by various grievances, racial or ethnic hatred, and influences from abroad. It says those threats were exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic and that the reopening of the economy could create new potential dangers. That alert was issued Friday by the Department of Homeland Security. Authorities say a Tesla involved in a deadly crash on a Southern California freeway last week may have been operating on autopilot. The crash in Fontana, east of Los Angeles, under federal investigation. The probe is the 29th case involving a Tesla that the agency has responded to. The head of the U.S. Health and Human Services Department says reports of unaccompanied migrant children being forced to stay overnight in parked buses at the Dallas Convention Center are completely unacceptable if true. Secretary Xavier Becerra said Friday that the agency is investigating. It's unclear how many children were kept on buses overnight at the K. Bailey Hutchinson Convention Center. It's 6:33, time for a check of the traffic and weather, and Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the outer loop of the Beltway in Virginia, there is a disabled vehicle. Left lane is blocked in Alexandria at Telegraph Road, exit 176. Use caution as you approach 176. That's the only delay on the Virginia side of the Beltway. On 66 in Fairfax County, you shouldn't find any delays eastbound or westbound. All clear in Virginia on 95 between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. And on the Maryland side of the Beltway, from Prince George's County through Montgomery County on the inner loop and on the outer loop, you won't be tapping the brakes. All clear, bridge to bridge. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny this morning, cool conditions to start your day, but temperatures will warm up into the mid-70s through the afternoon. We'll see a hit or miss shower, but for the most part, very isolated. Later on tonight, lows back in the 50s. Clouds will increase after midnight, mostly cloudy into your Sunday morning. I think we'll be dry tomorrow morning, but we will have the possibility for some afternoon showers. Could even have a couple rumbles of thunder. Not quite as warm either. High temperatures around 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
46 degrees, 6:34 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Just like old times, join me, Dan Bongino, live on WMAL, weekdays at noon, beginning May 24th.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Jennifer Harper joins us every week. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Hearings on the Hill about the border crisis, and the Secretary of Homeland Security continues to insist the border is closed. I don't think so. National news broadcasters and pundits seem to be protecting the president and the administration from the border crisis. And, of course, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, blames the whole thing on Trump. What have you got in the Beltway this week about it?
Well, the basic rule is that the broadcasters are shielding Biden from any kind of blame for the border. And we have to turn to our very good friends over there at the Media Research Center, because they went after that this week. And they have decided that the news organizations, that these are the major ABC, NBC, and CBS News, the major newscasters, are veiling the crisis. They're simply, you know, just soft-pedaling it, and they're downsizing their border coverage as well. And this is according to a new study that the folks at the Media Research Center released on Wednesday. And here's what they say. Even as the situation remained dire, coverage on the ABC, CBS, and NBC evening newscasts fell by more than 60%, from 113 minutes of airtime in March to just under 44 minutes in April. And our analysis shows the minuscule news coverage isn't the only favor that the liberal newsworks are doing for the White House. This is according to Rich Noyes. He's the senior editor over there that led the research. And he says that the networks are barely blaming Biden. He says Biden and his policies were completely shielded from blame in a majority of the 88 stories that aired during these 2 months, as less than one-third of them, 26 stories, included any reference by the reporter that the surge had anything to do with Biden, meaning the immigrant surge is continuing down there. Another 14 stories included sound bites from Republicans making this point, but without any confirmation from the correspondents. Viewers instead were told that Mr. Biden was, quote, facing a challenge at the southern border, and that was according to NBC anchor Lester Holt in late March, as if it were a hurricane or some other natural phenomenon, according to Mr. Noyes. And he said, if you want to see the complete report, it's very complete, covering lots of sound bites indeed. You can find that at newsbusters.org.
You know, I wonder how many pundits and newspersons may have been sitting in a gas line this week and might be waking up to the weakness in the Biden administration. While we're discussing the southern border, there was an eye-opener from the Associated Press this week.
Yeah, there was a lot of the press coverage was missing this week, perhaps, from the major broadcasters. But the Associated Press was really put out a comprehensive and somewhat startling report. They say the Biden administration is holding tens of thousands of asylum-seeking children in an opaque network of some 200 facilities that the Associated Press has learned spans two dozen states and includes five shelters with more than 1,000 children packed inside. Again, this is coming from the Associated Press this week, and their report is based on, quote, confidential data. So, it certainly reveals how dismal the situation is down there. And they say the number of migrant children in government custody more than doubled in the past 2 months. And this week, the federal government was housing 21,000 kids, from toddlers to teens. A facility at Fort Bliss, a U.S. Army post in El Paso, had more than 4,500 children as of Monday. On the base, think of that. Anyway, going right ahead, the attorneys, advocates, and mental health experts say that while some shelters are safe and provide adequate care, others are endangering children's health and safety. They go on also to say that more than half of all the migrant children detained in the U.S. are sleeping in shelters with more than 1,000 other kids. More than 17,650 are in facilities with 100 or more children, and some shelters and foster programs are small, little more than a house with a handful of kids. And last but not least, again, this is coming from the Associated Press, they say a large Houston facility abruptly closed after it was revealed that the children were being given plastic bags instead of access to restrooms. So that's your dismal report from the southern border from the AP.
If the news media won't keep counts, the Republican Party will. What are they saying about the management or mismanagement at the border?
Well, you got to hand it to the Republican National Committee, because they may be kind of quiet right now, but they do a lot of opposition research on the Democrats and what the heck's going on. This is coming from the Republican National Committee, and they say the border crisis is raging on. In fact, they call it President Biden's border crisis. And they cited 32 different examples of disarray and mismanagement, et cetera, and they backed it up with federal government statistics or press coverage. It was very well done, actually. And they said that border apprehensions continued to rise in April, with 178,622 migrants caught trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. Think of that. Think of how many people that is. Anyway, this is the highest one-month total in 20 years. It's nearly a 270% increase from the average number of April apprehensions during the Trump administration. And, of course, of over that 178,000 migrants taken into custody, 17,171 were unaccompanied minors, which troubles me a great deal. And they also went on to say that while border crossings are at a 20-year high, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement deportations have fallen to the lowest level on record. I could go on and on about this, but good for the Republican National Committee for coming out with the facts and putting them out there, because it matters.
Kind of interesting to see how many people are flocking to Florida. Ron DeSantis is the governor there. There have been a lot of rumblings about whether he might be on the ticket in 2024 for the Republicans. And tell us a little bit about Ron DeSantis and his fundraising.
Yes, numbers always talk, don't they, in these situations? I mean, Ron DeSantis has kind of turned into the mighty DeSantis at this point, because things are going kind of swimmingly in the fundraising department for the Florida governor. This is according to friends of Ron DeSantis, his political committee. They raised $14 million during the month of April. That's a lot. Anyway, they say the strong showing follows a hot March, where the political committee raised $5.1 million, and now they have $17 million cash on hand at this point, and it's $31.7 million total for their cash on hand. This is according to FloridaPolitics.com, which if you're curious about all that, it's a good place to check out. And they are noting that this war chest will be augmented by much buzz, because Mr. DeSantis, as you mentioned, could very possibly run for U.S. president in 2021. And they also point out that one of Mr. DeSantis's competition down there raised just $361,000 in April. So they only have $1.5 million on hand. So competition, maybe it'll get fierce later on, but it isn't so much right now.
We've been all over the road this week on vaccines, going back to school, masks, herd immunity, and Republicans and Democrats don't seem to get any closer to agreeing on any of this stuff either.
They certainly don't. And this is a very interesting poll. It's actually coming from Harvard University T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundations. And they have determined that Republicans and Democrats, it's not only their political beliefs, but they have completely polarized attitudes towards public health agencies and health providers. So it's not just the mask that they're disagreeing on. It says, when it comes to trusting the recommendations of different groups to improve health, there are major differences in views between Democrats and Republicans. And just for example, 52% of U.S. adults overall, Rick, they trust the recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control, that's the CDC. Now, three-fourths of Democrats agree with that, but only 27% of Republicans agree with that. Big gap there. Also, the overall public gave their respective local health department a 53% positive performance rating. And among Republicans, the number was 40%. Among Democrats, it was 64%. And just a couple more things that they do agree upon. 70% overall Americans trust their health care workers that they know. 70% of Republicans and 78% of Democrats agree with that. And 67% overall trust the recommendations of their doctors. 52% of Republicans agree with that, along with 80% of Democrats. They seem to be more trustful. And last but not least, 40% overall trust the recommendations for their health from friends or family. 46% of Republicans agree with that, along with 35% of Democrats. Again, this is coming from Harvard University and Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Again, just pointing out the giant gap between Democrats and Republicans right now.
One of the cable news networks is making an offer to active duty military and veterans.
Yes, indeed. This is just really neat. This is a very timely gesture of generosity. This is Fox News, and they have announced that Fox Nation, Rick, this is the on-demand video streaming platform of Fox News, a very good site there. They are offering a special promotion of a year of free access to Fox Nation to all active United States military members and veterans as part of its Grateful Nation initiative in honor of Memorial Day. So between May 24th and 31st, any active member of the armed services or military veteran will be able to opt into this special offering and receive a one-year free subscription. Great. Anyway, they say it's going to be beginning May the 25th. Fox Nation will showcase lots of programming and tribute to members of the United States military. That includes Hero Dogs. I love the idea of that. America's Top Ranger, Modern Warriors, and USA Inc. And that's spotlighting uplifting stories of veterans and the heroism and their selfless dedication. But again, if you're curious about doing this, just go to the Fox Nation website between May 24th and 31st. Pass this on to your military folks and vets and your family. And according to Fox Nation President Jason Klarman, he said, "We are honored to celebrate our servicemen and women by contributing in a small way to those who have sacrificed so much on behalf of our nation." Just a nice feel-good things, and good for you, Fox. Thought that was good.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and you can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. It's 6:48, the Saturday morning update, and time for a check of the traffic and weather. Then we'll talk to Jim Trusty. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In D.C. on 295, 395, and 695, plus the tunnels and bridges. Right now this morning, there isn't any construction being set up. I don't have any reports of any accidents, so you should be at speed. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, Prince George's County and Montgomery County, you won't be hitting the brakes on the inner loop or the outer loop bridge to bridge. And between the two beltways on the VW Parkway and 95, that's clear northbound and southbound. And Route 50 in Prince George's County between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, all clear eastbound and westbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny this morning, cool conditions to start your day, but temperatures will warm up into the mid-70s through the afternoon. We'll see a hit or miss shower, but for the most part, very isolated. Later on tonight, lows back in the 50s. Clouds will increase after midnight, mostly cloudy into your Sunday morning. I think we'll be dry tomorrow morning, but we will have the possibility likely for some afternoon showers. Could even have a couple rumbles of thunder. Not quite as warm either. High temperatures around 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
46 degrees, 649 on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. It's good to have you along with us. Jim Trusty joins us every week. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, and he is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
You spent decades at the Department of Justice, and during the Trump administration, there were accusations that the Department of Justice was being used as a political weapon and was being politicized. How do you define a Department of Justice as to whether it's politics or whether it's priorities as to the direction they take?
Yeah, it's a great question, and sometimes you have to see it in action for a while to really spot what you might call politics as opposed to political or policy type decisions. And there's a very small or thin line between the two. But look, over time, you always see differences in the Department of Justice priorities. And, you know, there are stated priorities that come down from the president through the attorney general. Examples would be Robert F. Kennedy caring about the mafia. That was a big point of emphasis in the late 1960s. Or John Ashcroft, when he was the attorney general, I was in the department, and he wanted to see more obscenity and pornography prosecutions. So there's always a little bit of flavoring that comes from the top in terms of what they want to emphasize. But generally, this is like a big aircraft carrier, and it's very difficult to move all components of that ship in any sort of radical direction. So when it comes to individual U.S. attorney's offices or departments within or divisions within the Department of Justice, they tend to keep doing a lot of the priorities that matter for that locale, and then dabble on the side with the new priorities that are coming down from on high.
How would you characterize the priorities of the Trump administration versus what you're seeing so far the priorities of the Biden administration?
Well, in a lot of ways, the Trump administration let the U.S. attorney's offices have their autonomy. And a lot of the U.S. attorney's offices, you know, really focused on what was important within their district. So for Maryland, for instance, that meant they continued to fight gangs. They did a lot of gang prosecutions, although certainly not the only thing they did. In other places, you might see more of an emphasis on white collar, but it was pretty decentralized in a lot of ways. There were high-profile moments where the attorney general would have to get involved in cases that related to the Mueller probe, for instance. But all in all, a lot of the ships kept sailing under their own steam. What you're seeing right now from the new department, and it's very new, seems to be a pretty radical reorganization of things. I mean, really the biggest thing that I see is the ascent of the Civil Rights Division. The Civil Rights Division is particularly aggressive and high profile and really staking a claim all across the country right now.
Help us understand the term civil rights, because I think depending on when you grew up, and what you've heard in the news or what you've read in the history books, civil rights could mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. How would you define it for this discussion?
Yeah, it's actually surprisingly broad and therefore pretty hard to define. But look, I mean, civil rights, the panoply of statutes that they deal with, the types of cases that they can go after, either criminally or civilly, is pretty broad. It certainly includes what they call typical civil rights violations, 1983 actions, which means suing people for racism, essentially, for institutionalized racism. And they also have had a long history of getting involved in at least some high-profile police abuse cases that seem to break down on race. They're also involved in human trafficking prosecutions, and particularly international ones where there's either smuggling or trafficking coming across the Mexican border. So they have a wide range of responsibilities. How they enforce these things, how they fan out and try to tackle these types of complicated cases has differed over the years. And right now we're seeing probably the most aggressive early stages of the Civil Rights Division in this administration that I could imagine.
Jim, I saw a story recently where the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice was getting involved in the audit of the voting in Arizona. And in what context are they involved?
Yeah, that's really interesting in terms of what's going on, and it's very aggressive. So DOJ has some pretty blurry lines when it comes to election integrity. The U.S. Attorney's offices have a role. The public integrity section has a branch called election crimes. And civil rights also, that division, they all have some authority to act on election fraud issues. But in this case in Arizona, where you have the Maricopa County recount being administered by, I guess, the Arizona Senate, it was a really surprisingly aggressive moment. They received a letter from the principal deputy attorney general, the number two at civil rights, that basically says, we've been reading newspaper articles and we're not really sure that you're not breaking federal law if you intimidate voters or if you continue to do certain things in your audit of the Arizona election. And that's really kind of astounding. There's no evidence. They're just reading newspaper clips. They're weighing in with essentially what is a cease and desist letter. It's kind of a soft version of a cease and desist letter. And I find that to be astounding. I mean, I don't think I can think of another situation where civil rights tried to essentially put a chill on a legitimate investigation by saying they think there could be federal violations someday if it continues.
Another thing we've been hearing about recently with DOJ is the pattern and practice investigations, and we're seeing these in the local police departments in Louisville, Kentucky, and in Minneapolis. Tell us a little bit about these. We've talked about them before, but I think as it fits into this conversation.
Sure. Well, again, it's a type of thing that's had ebbs and flows over time. I mean, during the Trump administration, I think because the attorney general was pretty much a federalist, he didn't like the idea of federal takeovers of local police departments. Now, in the Obama years, and from what we've seen so far this year, the administration that's in there now is quite comfortable with the idea of looking over the shoulder of local departments, at least when there's high-profile incidents like what happened in Louisville, like what happened in Minneapolis. So I think we're tip of the iceberg. There's a comfort that they seem to have with extending the federal reach into these small jurisdictions. And keep in mind, none of these jurisdictions, whether they have the financial resources in general or not, are going to be able to stay in a fight with the threat of civil litigation from the Department of Justice. It is a big machine. And even if there's political will to fight back, typically these things are going to end in civil settlements, what they call consent decrees, and years of supervision of those departments by the Department of Justice. So if you're a true federalist, you have to bristle at the idea that states, counties, and cities are apparently incapable of doing what the brilliant folks in Washington can do when it comes to police management.
And the Civil Rights Division has also indicted the four officers in Minneapolis, right?
They have, yeah. And that's a really, again, intriguing show of muscle at this point. You know, I look back and think about the LAPD case with Rodney King back in the early 90s. And if you think about it, the feds jumped in that case to go after the officers after they were acquitted in the California State Court. So civil rights at that point stepped in with almost identical charges to what they filed in Minnesota last week to take another shot at bad police officers. And that was kind of the justification. It's not double jeopardy, but there is a policy similar to the idea of double jeopardy that says the Fed should have some compelling reason before they double up on the same criminal conduct. Well, in Rodney King's case, that's what happened. They pursued these officers. They got convictions in the federal trial after the state acquittals. Here in Minnesota, they filed the charges after a conviction of Officer Chauvin before sentencing, so no sign of injustice there, and while three other officers' cases were pending. So this is a very early aggressive move by this new emboldened Civil Rights Division.
And what's the latest on the talk of the defense seeking another trial in the Chauvin case?
Well, I think that the judge that presided over Chauvin's case and that has the other three officers is starting to get increasingly sensitive to outside interference. Remember, he had some choice words about Maxine Waters making her comments while the case was still going on. He probably wasn't thrilled that President Biden weighed in, even though the jury was sequestered at that point. There's just a steady drumbeat of outside the courtroom influences, and now you have the federal indictment. So he's moved the trial of the remaining three officers to early next year, which was a really interesting moment because, number one, he's sensitive to the pretrial publicity. He said maybe things will cool down by then. But number two, he's opening up the door for the feds to basically come in and try their case. And that could be this moment of be careful what you ask for in terms of the civil rights attorneys, because they will have a tough case against those other three officers no matter what happened with Officer Chauvin.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Jim, always appreciate your perspective. Give us some real background on these things we hear in the news. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's always fun to be on with you.
And we're coming up on the 7 o'clock news. Then we'll be back with John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington.
America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station.